Okay, so I'm going to talk about some work I've done with my colleagues in the Computer Science Department at Dartmouth and Thayer School of Engineering and the Geisel School of Medicine. So I'm interested in wearable sensing systems and in particular how they can be used in the context of mobile health. And what that means is how can we use these systems to help monitor a person's health for both personal and medical reasons. And I'm sure many of us are very familiar with these kind of systems, but if you're not, this is sort of the ecosystem that's out there. And basically, there's just a bunch of sensors that a person could wear and that would sense themselves or perhaps the environment that they're in. And these sensors tend to be pretty dumb, so what ends up happening is they communicate to some sort of gateway or mobile node, and together they form something called a wireless body area network. Optionally, the mobile node or gateway might communicate with some electronic or personal health record, but that's sort of out of scope in this for this talk. There are also wired body area networks, but I think those are pretty intrusive. But in this sort of point of intrusiveness and usability, I'll come back to throughout this talk. So these kind of systems actually exist today. If you go out to Best Buy, you can buy things like this. I think the best example is probably the Fitbit, which is the one on the bottom in the middle. And what this allows you to do is sort of monitor your activity throughout the day. So this is things like the number of steps you've taken, distance traveled, sleeping patterns, and calories burned. And if you look at these devices from a physician's point of view, they're going to be very skeptical of their use in a medical context. So a physician will ask questions like, did these sensors come from a trustworthy manufacturer? How were they calibrated? What kind of algorithms are you using to do inference? Are there any guarantees that these things were actually applied correctly to a patient? How is the data being protected? So there's all kinds of questions surrounding these things. But in this talk, I want to really focus on one particular problem is, and that is how can we provide some assurance or some kind of assurance that these devices are actually sensing the person that they're claiming to be sensing. So in the case of the Fitbit, when you buy this thing, you go online and register it to yourself, and it's sort of statically associated with you. And even though it may be, employing some cryptographic means to maintain that association, I could always give it to you, and you could put it on yourself, and suddenly it would be collecting data about you, but it would be labeling it as my data. And that's a bad thing. It might not be so bad in the case of a pedometer like the Fitbit, but you can imagine scenarios and sensors where this would be an issue. So when thinking about solutions to these kind of problems, it's always important to keep in mind this usability requirement. And this is very important because when it comes to these kind of devices, they're often targeted at populations that, like the elderly, the young, the ill, or disabled. And I like this particular quote because what it's basically saying is that the user should really have to do nothing. They just put the sensor on, whether they strap it onto themselves, they stick it onto themselves, or put it in their pocket, or perhaps even implanted or ingested, and it should just work. That's a nice sort of thing. That's the ideal situation that you would want to be in. And sometimes, though, however, a device might actually require sort of some input from the user, but the focus should really be on minimizing that those kind of operations. And I believe like this ability to operate unobtrusively and sort of collect this in situ data throughout and really integrate into a person's life will be vital to the success of these kind of systems. So in the context of all those problems I described before. This means that somebody should be able to buy these sensors and without any other action on their part, put it on themselves. The sensor nodes would discover each other, recognize that they're on the same body, and then transitively learn whose body they're actually on, and then independently somehow compute some secrets so that they can establish secure and reliable communications. So when you think about this problem of how can they actually learn or decide whose body they're on, you can think of a lot of solutions, and the one that usually comes to people's minds is biometrics. So, there's two classes of biometrics. There's physiological ones and behavioral ones. In physiological biometrics, what they do is they utilize something about your personal physiology to identify you. And these are things that people are very familiar with: fingerprints, hand geometry, facial recognition, or retinal recognition. On the other spectrum, there's behavioral biometrics, and these use something about the way you go about your life to identify you. So, the way you type on a keyboard, how you talk, how you walk, or even how you sign your name. And these things are great, but I'm not convinced that they're very usable or, in some cases, secure enough. So something like a retinal scan is very secure because, you have this thing, you put it to your eye, and it can pretty accurately identify people out of a very large population, but it's also very intrusive. You know, I have to put this thing actually up to my eye. Same thing with the fingerprint reader. I have to put my fingerprint on the actual reader. But on the other side, you have these behavioral ones, which are nice because they sort of integrate into your life. If I have something like a speaker identification system, I can just talk and it would be like, hey, that's me speaking, or that it knows that it's me speaking, and it can just sort of passively label that. But that brings up a problem. I just record your voice, play it back, and it suddenly thinks, you know, you're there, even though you're not. And people have got around these things, or found solutions to these problems. And what ends up happening is, you know, we want sort of a combination of some properties of the physiological and another property of the behavioral one. So I call this those two things a passive biometric. And most biometrics exhibit these three traits. They're universal, unique, and permanent. And so when you think about a biometric, you want to understand, you know, how is my biometric, how does it relate to these three characteristics? So in terms of universality, if you're doing a fingerprint reader, you know, some people may not have fingers, so then how do you account for that? And the whole point of these is just to think about how your biometric is affected by whatever the characteristic is. In terms of uniqueness, you can target different population sizes. You know, it's not always the case that you have to be able to identify the whole world. Sometimes you can just look at a smaller population. And there's some interesting research that shows, I mean, for like a height sensor, you know, it might not be able to identify everybody in the world, but you can probably identify everybody in the household. And in fact, I think for most wearable sensing systems, they're only going to ever see, you know, a very small subset of all people in the world. So something like a household size is probably our target population. And then there's permanence. You know, how stable is this biometric over time? Obviously, as you age, your voice changes. You know, your face can change if some accident happens, or your fingerprints can actually fade. So that's going to affect the biometric. And then the last two traits, which sort of go into why I call them passive biometrics, is this idea that they should be unobtrusively measurable and that they should be difficult to circumvent. So I previously explained what these mean, but unobtrusively measurable, it shouldn't require anybody's user input. It's getting back to this sort of usability principle. And the circumvention, it shouldn't be that easy to circumvent, where I could just record your voice and play it back. So in the context of this talk, I'm going to focus mostly on uniqueness, the unobtrusiveness, and the difficult to circumvent aspects, and the last two are kind of future work. So, So we propose using bioimpedance, and if you don't know what bioimpedance is, if you ever used a scale that sort of tells your body composition, that was using bioimpedance. Basically, they can relate how bioimpedance relates to fat content. So bioimpedance is a physiological property related to the tissue's resistance to electrical current flow, and also its ability to store charge. And it's a function of three things. So you have the tissue itself, things like, is there blood, fat, muscle, bone? What is the state of the actual tissue? You know, how dense are your bones? How hydrated are the cells? And the anatomic orientation of the tissue. So how is the bone and muscle oriented relative to what you're measuring? And it is because of these three things that we think that bioimpedance is going to make a sort of unique marker for identifying individuals. And one can measure this basically by applying italic metrodes, which are these gray things up here, and applying a small sinusoidal current between these electrodes. And then what ends up happening is you create an electrical field in a tissue, and this results in a measurable voltage change. And this is due to the actual tissue. So then what different tissues end up exhibiting different characteristics depending on, you know, what frequency you're sending in the current. So what we end up doing is you can sweep over a bunch of different frequencies because you have a bunch of different tissue. So then you have basically, you end up doing something called electrical impedance spectroscopy. What you get is these complex values, which are represented by these Z values, that represent both the reactance and resistance of the tissue at some specific frequency. And finally, there's two ways of measuring. There's a bipolar way and a tetrapolar way. And as the names imply, for a bipolar measurement, you're using the same two electrodes to apply current that you're also using to measure the voltage difference. In the tetrapolar case, you're applying current through two electrodes, and then you're measuring from two different electrodes. So you might think, well, what's the difference? Well, bipolar measurements end up suffering from something called contact impedance. And what ends up happening is at the site where the electrode contacts the skin, there's a contact impedance, which is a kind of a noise that occurs when the current is applied. In the case of the tetrapolar, you don't get that, so it's a little less noisy. But the problem is the tetrapolar ones end up being more complex to manufacture in terms of hardware, so it's sort of an economic balance there. So basically, what we imagine is a device like a watch that a person would wear and could measure their bioimpedance at their wrist. And this is, unfortunately, the device we had. It's very large. You cannot wear this. but that's an engineering problem that we're trying to solve. So what we ended up doing is a person would put on this bracelet in the bottom right, and it has 8 electrodes, and they would ask to keep their arm still for about 20 minutes while we collected all this data from them. And the laptop would work with the multiplexer to change the electrode configuration, and then the impedance analyzer would measure the impedance for that given electrode pattern. So we think the wrist is a nice location because it has sort of several technical advantages. If it's like a watch-like device, it's always worn more or less in the same way. You don't sort of move it from wrist to wrist. And this alleviates a lot of issues that one would have with placement and orientation. And then second, you can instrument a watch or some watch-like device to actually detect when it is put on a person, because you can have an electrical circuit completed when it's clasped together. And this is nice because you can save energy and only do recognition when you believe the device is actually on a person, or at least clasped together. And then by virtue of actually being a watch, it has contact with the person's skin, which is a property we need. Otherwise, we wouldn't actually be able to get the bioimpedance. And so there are some other advantages, and we talk about this in our paper called Amulet. So we're interested in this wrist-worn device. And in terms of the anatomy of the wrist, there are skeletal bones, the radius and ulna, arteries, veins, nerves, muscle, fat, and skin, and all kinds of fluids in there. And over the frequency ranges of 10 kilohertz to 10 megahertz, others have reported that bioimpedance is relatively stable for both bone and fat tissue. However, in muscle, skin, and blood, the values increase monotonically with frequency. So from person to person, wrist sizes will vary, obviously, and skin thickness in accordance, and water content, bone size, vascular size, and locations, and fat content. And all of these sort of features of the anatomy of the wrist will contribute to the actual impedance value measured. So for example, if I have a larger wrist than you, this is going to change the configuration of where the electrodes are actually on my wrist. And then as a result, or because you have a larger wrist, the distribution of the tissues is also going to be different as well. And so we hypothesized then this is sort of a unique feature of everybody's wrists, or it should be unique to you. As I said, we used 8 electrodes, and this is sort of the numbering scheme we used. So when we measure bioimpedance, we get this complex value, and that represents the resistance and reactance of the tissue. And what we see here is basically 5 are curves from one person's particular measurements for a specific electrode pattern. We measured the impedances at logarithmically spaced frequencies from 10 kilohertz to 10 megahertz, and this results in these curves. So the measurements are relatively stable except on the extreme frequencies. In the middle, they're pretty stable, but as you get towards the edge, there's some noise that occurs. So then how do we account for this? So we want to extract some features from these curves. So the first 6 features that we do is basically we fit a line in logarithmic space to both the resistance, the reactance, and the magnitude curves. And so because a line can actually be described by a slope and intercept, we basically get 2 features for each of these 3 parts, resulting in 6 features. And then finally, we add a 7th feature, which is the maximum magnitude over all frequencies. And we chose this because when I was looking at the data, it seemed like everybody seemed to exhibit a pretty unique maxima. Given a bunch of these feature vectors I described from a single bioimpedance, you want to employ some sort of algorithm to do enrollment and recognition. The first thing the device would do is sort of collect a bunch of training feature vectors from a desired set of subjects, and then use these to train a classifier where the class corresponds to the subject, to a particular subject. So we tested a bunch of classifiers, and what ended up working up the best is a naive Bayes classifier. And if you don't know what an IA Bayes classifier is, it's pretty simple. It just sort of independently models each feature by computing a mean invariance. And since these are continuous values, it assumes sort of there's an underlying Gaussian distribution. So once the classifier has learned this particular model, it can then use a recognition algorithm to determine who is wearing the device. And if you sort of know machine learning, this is pretty obvious. And what you do is basically compute a new bioimpedance and the test or a feature vector from that, and you ask the classifier, okay, which person do you think this is? And in terms of a naive Bayes one, it's just basically choosing the label with the maximum likelihood given the learned parameters. So in order to actually test these algorithms, what we ended up doing was running a leave one out bioimpedance cross-validation over all the subjects to actually compute some metrics, which I'll describe next. So there are a bunch of parameters we can play with to see how well these algorithms would work. And the first is the number of subjects we trained on. And as I said before, you know, you can look at, you know, the whole population, or you can look at a subset of the population. Because we don't think that, or at least we think that these devices will only see a small set of people, we looked at 2 subjects, 3 subjects, 4 subjects, and 5. And then we also looked at all subjects just to see how well we'd classify over everyone in our data set. The second thing we can play with is the electrode patterns. So you can choose like all kinds of combinations of electrode patterns for both bipolar and tetrapolar measurements. But if you do the math, there's a lot, and it would take a very long time to actually run all these measurements. So what we ended up choosing were the electrodes that have the maximal distance from each other. So in the case of a bipolar, it'd be like the top and bottom, left and right, and then the ones in between. So that's 4-8, 4-8, if you remember back from the original diagram, was the top and bottom. 2-6 was in the sides of the wrist. And then we did the same thing for the tetrapolar measurements, in that for the currents that are applying, you choose the maximal distance, and for the currents that are, or the electrodes that are sensing, you choose the next maximal, so because you can't choose the same electrodes. So we ended up collecting this measurements from 46 subjects. 22 were male and 24 were female. The average age was about 21 years old. All of them were greater than 8, or older than 8, or 18 or older. So we took 5 measurements for each electrode pattern, as shown above. And this is about 80 measurements per person. And this takes like 20 minutes to do. And this resulted in 3,680 total measurements. So in terms of those algorithms, we need to somehow summarize. We need summary statistics to see how well they perform. And because when you have really large cohort sizes, you have an imbalance of data between negative and positive examples, or, you know, genuine and imposter examples, we compute something called balanced accuracy. And all that's doing is weighting the true accept rate versus the true reject rate. And we also show the false accept rate and the false reject rate, which is computed on the side given this table. And basically, all they tell us is how many imposters would we have accepted and how many genuine subjects would we have rejected. And these are useful measures to know. Basically, you want large balanced accuracies and low false rejects and false accepts. So the first experiment we ran were on the bipolar measurements only. And the top chart shows the metrics for leave one out bioimpedance cross-validation averaged over all subjects for a single bipolar electrode pattern. That's kind of a mouthful. So the top 3 performing bipolar patterns were 4-8-4-8, 2-6-2-6, 3-7-3-7. In the bottom chart, we did it for multiple patterns. So basically, we can measure, you know, multiple bioimpedance measures and then concatenate them together into sort of a super feature vector and do classification or enrollment and verification on that as well. But again, you see, if you notice the patterns, they tend to be the top and bottom and left and right of your wrist, which is interesting because, you know, this is that's where it has to travel through the maximal amount of tissue and diversity of tissue, actually, because on the sides you go through the bone, the ulnus, and both the radius. When you go on the top and bottom, you're sort of going through most of the fat. So for each chart, the numbers at the bottom represent the cohort size, so 2, 3, 4, 5, and then all the subjects. And as the cohort size increases, you would expect the recognition rates to go down, and they do. And the differences between the single and multiple pattern are pretty negligible. There's not much difference. So if you're going to build something that uses bipolar measurements, it's probably best just to go with a single bipolar measurement. So then we did the same thing with the tetrapolar measurements. And we see some of the same things. You know, there's not much difference between using multiple tetrapolar patterns versus using a single tetrapolar pattern. But if you do use multiple, your false accept rates tend to go down, which, you know, for certain applications might be a good thing. So you should probably use multiple tetrapolar measurements in that case. So compared to the previous slide, these results are more or less the same with except for the lowering in the false accepts. And we basically get about 85% recognition accuracy. And since bipolar measurements can be done with cheaper hardware, it's probably better to go with bipolar measurements until we can improve these recognition rates for tetrapolar measurements. And again, we see the top and bottom patterns perform the best, where 4.8, again, is the top and bottom, where and when it's sensing, 3.7 is sort of right next to it. So it's the natural question to ask is, how can we improve these recognition rates? We can obviously engineer better features to extract from these curves, but the actual sort of genesis of this work was we noticed in a paper of our colleagues that she was using wrist circumference to identify people, and we're like, okay, that's cool. So what we ended up actually doing was collecting wrist circumferences at the same time. And so the top chart actually shows the distribution of wrist circumferences for a person or for our subjects divided into male and females. And obviously males have larger wrist sizes, so they tend to be on the right, and women tend to be on the left. And if you were to run sort of a simple classifier on these to see how well they do, you'd be able to accurately identify people 98% of the time. However, that's assuming there's no measurement error. So then what happens if you actually induce a measurement error? Well, we didn't take multiple measurements of people. We only took one measurement. So what we ended up doing is choosing 10 linearly spaced measurements, or computing 10 linearly spaced measurements for some desired error measurement. And that's with D0, 1, 5, and 10. It's in millimeters. So if you had 5 millimeters of error, you would get whatever you would assume the measurement we took was the mean and just compute from there. So even with something like a modest increase in 1 millimeter of measurement error, your recognition rates would quickly drop to like 54% for over all subjects. So this implies that, you know, for small cohorts, this wrist circumference is a pretty good distinguisher, but for larger cohorts, it just would not work. So then what we ended up doing was combining these two things together. So basically, you would compute the bioimpedance features and then concatenate on their wrist circumference measurement as well. And so here we show the same measures for a cohort size of 5 subjects with both bipolar and tetrapolar measurements. And so when combined together, what ends up happening is the false reject rate and false accept rates fall compared to the previous slide. And so if you wanted to build a device that can measure both the wrist circumference and bioimpedance, which you might be able to do to measure wrist circumference if you use a strain gauge of some sort. We think this kind of device would be ideal for mobile health applications, and especially for larger cohort sizes because of the lower false accept rates. So in summary, we collected a bunch of wrist bioimpedance and circumferences from about 46 subjects. And we used this naive Bayes classifier to accurately identify subjects 85% of the time. Using a single bipolar electrode pattern. You can boost this to 90% if you just add wrist circumference as an additional feature. And sort of the remaining work here is to actually understand how this biometric would change over time. It's something we don't know. There are a lot of factors that can go into that. So we've been developing this wearable prototype on the Shimmer platform and a custom daughter board we built that someone could probably easily wear for a week or so to collect this bioimpedance data. So thank you. Go ahead.
When you did the mic pull, it's not going to be on the video.
When you did your cohort studies, for example, anything less than 46, which I take to be your subject pool.
Yeah.
Did you just draw, for example, two at random, or did you?
Yeah, so we actually computed over.
Did you do repeated draws?
We did repeated draws. Yeah.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
And of the suite of classifiers that you used, could you say what some of the other ones were?
So we used k-nearest neighbors. We did linear discriminant analysis. I did a random forest. What else did I do? Logistic regression. Things like that.
My lab does biometrics too. Our results are kind of similar to yours, except for the classifier. So I'm curious to know what you would do next, or what do you think is the impediment to, say, getting close to 100%?
I don't know. So, I mean, in the machine learning community, there's sort of a split between engineering better features, which is something you could spend a lot of your whole thesis on doing, or you can learn features by having a bunch of unlabeled examples. So I think, I mean, obviously the features are going to affect the ability of the classifier to classify well. So I could spend more time doing that, but I don't know. I feel like this is good enough, and the rest of it is just a lot of engineering effort to get to the better recognition accuracies.
Our experience is that it's noise in the data.
Yeah, it's also noisy. But that's also an engineering problem, I think, in a lot of ways. So if we could get the better features to do for, because the tetrapolar measurements have lower noise, and we can engineer better features from those measurements, then we'd probably get better recognition rates. But
Can I ask one quick question? It's kind of a satellite question. I was curious about your experience with the IRB. I assume this went through IRB approval. This is something that I think is maybe a little new to computer scientists, and I assume affects a lot of people in this room. So can you talk a little bit about your interaction with the IRB?
So it was really easy. But we were lucky because the device we were using is used by another professor at the Thayer School, and he does this to do cancer studies. So you can use electrical impedance spectroscopy to actually determine if cells are cancerous or not. And he's used this on people before, and the IRB has already approved that. So basically we said, well, we've used this device before in the context of this study, and you've already approved that, so you should approve this as well. And they did, and in fact, it was very minimal effort to get it approved. And the current we're applying is like, if you ever stuck a 9-volt battery to your tongue, it's less than that, so you wouldn't even feel it.
I see.
Yeah.
And your 46 subjects were Dartmouth students?
Yeah, they're all, yeah.
did you feel there was any biasing there? I mean.
No, because, so if you think about it, so if our target population is like a family, you're going to have a diversity of ages, you know. And our population is very homogenous, so it makes it more difficult to actually recognize who you are or identify the subjects.
I see.